This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Gas explosion 50 miles off Louisiana that you can imagine. Think Mount St. Helens underwater.
Underwater.
What that would do is create a cloud of incredible toxic material, which would then drift with the winds over the shore where there are millions of people.
What about a tsunami?
The next step is you would get a tsunami.
Really?
We will enact a martial law in the southern United States. There may be mass FEMA evacuations.
Oh, the FEMA camps. And kill millions of people, you said. Oh, please. And some of this garbage went out over hundreds of stations on Coast to Coast AM. It gets worse. I expect this to triumph on YouTube, but the whole story, based on unnamed geologists, inside government sources, and wait for it, aliens, was reworked by DK Matai and reposted on sites that should know better, like the Huffington Post. As far as I can tell, the original source for these Gulf Terror stories is Richard C. Hoagland, who explained it all on the George Noory Show. The same theory was remade by Dr. Bill Deagle on Bill Ryan's Project Avalon program. And what do all these people have in common?
This is being driven by transdimensional super beings that are, in a sense, the gods of the ancient world, the same ones like Apollo, Apollyon.
Exactly.
There's a whole list of the names, and I can actually give you the actual names that people want to know. And they can go back to James Weir's Book of Demonology, 1535. They can look at ancient books that are sequestered in the Vatican Library if people are listening that know about this.
That's right. They believe aliens run the show here on Earth and probably caused this spill for their own nefarious purposes. Watch your sources, folks. Meanwhile, as we'll hear from Stephanie Mensimer, an investigative reporter for Mother Jones magazine, the far right and some Tea Party movements agree that the Gulf spill is a plot to move Dixie into horrible FEMA camps while Obama kills off America with the dreaded carbon tax. Have we lost our collective minds? Why do Americans love to terrorize themselves?
Ever since the beginning of time, man has pitted himself against the power of the sea to learn its secrets, to solve its mysteries. Many stories have been told of ships and the men who sailed them.
Antiball!
Did you see him, man?
I'm going to make a bold prediction. The BP well is not going to cause the Gulf of Mexico to erupt into a world-ending volcano. Millions of people will not die because of this. There will be no tidal wave. Look, folks, things are bad enough in the Gulf as they are. They are unprecedented. But any of these experts could find out their theories were so much BS by simply asking a few sane scientists. Try calling up a geologist. That's what I did for this week's show. We'll ask Dr. Samantha Joy, an expert on both oil and the Deepwater Gulf, about these viral fears. More important, Dr. Joy is just back from a research mission in the Gulf to measure those underwater plumes of oil and gas. You'll get the latest. Then we go to the chief scientist of the big conservation group Oceana, Dr. Michael Hirschfield, to investigate a real threat to the Gulf. Masses of methane are accumulating under the sea and leaking out into the atmosphere as potent climate-changing gases. What does that mean for sea life and for the oil industry? Three interviews, and then I'll return to our deepest fears, looking at the cranksters who love to wind us up with horrible bedtime stories. And one more rumor about geopolitics, why America needs BP. And it's to feed the war machine. I'm Alex Smith. Let's get started with the newest science first. This is Alex Smith. You have heard about giant plumes of oil hidden under the Gulf of Mexico. Dr. Samantha B. Joy is a professor in the Department of Marine Sciences at the University of Georgia. She has just returned from a research vessel in the Gulf of Mexico investigating those oil plumes from the leaking Deepwater Horizon well. Dr. Joy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex.
Alex. Thanks for having me.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time for us. In a few minutes, I want to ask you just quickly about a couple of fantastic rumors of doom sweeping the Internet, but I really want to start with the science. Can you tell us about your recent journey to the Gulf of Mexico?
Sure. So we departed on a small research vessel, the Walton Smith, that's run out of the University of Miami. And we had a suite of instrumentation, both optical and acoustic, so using both light and sound to track the distribution of oil and other materials in the water column around the Deepwater Horizon leaking wellhead. And the goal of our work was really to follow up on a previous research cruise on board the research vessel Pelican, where they had first discovered underwater plumes of oil around the leaking wellhead. And during our two-week cruise, we confirmed the Pelican findings and found that there are, in fact, these underwater plumes that are characterized by high concentrations of both dissolved gas as well as oil and dissolved organic carbon. And the plumes have, you know, elevated rates of microbial activity in addition to these elevated rates of microbial substrates, which is what you might expect.
So what does it mean that the microbes are busy on this?
Well, most of the organisms right now that are eating the oil and gas in the water are oxygen consumers. So they respire oxygen just like we respire oxygen. And by carrying out their regular metabolism, they consume oxygen and deplete it from the water. And the problem is that eventually, if they sustain the rates of activity that they're expressing right now, the concern is that they'll draw oxygen levels down below those which support larger animals. And that magic threshold is around 2 milligrams of oxygen per liter.
So we could get some dead zones.
We could get low oxygen water that basically is not hospitable and not inhabitable by any organism that requires oxygen. So effectively, you know, deep sea, hypoxic, anoxic waters.
Well, as you know, in the early days of the spill, NOAA based the magnitude of leaking oil on the sheen as seen from space, and then, as you say, the Pelican found these underwater plumes, and BP CEO Tony Hayward said they didn't exist because oil always floats to the surface. Why did these plumes form in this particular accident?
Well, the difference between the Deepwater Horizon and all other previous drilling accidents is the water depth. We're talking about a very deep water column here, 5,000 feet. And when you introduce oil and gas at that water depth in the manner in which it's being introduced, basically it's being forced at a very high velocity out of a very small orifice, about a 21-inch pipe, you're fractionating it and breaking it into small particles. And it doesn't take a very small particle. You know, you can get it down to, you know, hundreds of microns or thereabouts. And when you do that, then the surface tension of the particle, it is greater than the buoyancy force pushing the particle up. So the surface tension is holding it down, and that force is greater than the buoyancy force that's making it want to rise, so it stays underwater. And this is something that has been shown in models, both theoretically and in the laboratory. So it really is not a difficult thing to imagine and understand why this would happen at this water depth and under these conditions.
Perhaps related to the size of those particles, some people are now changing the terms, moving from the word plume to the idea of a cloud. How should we understand what is really down there? It's not thick, gooey black oil, is it?
Oh, absolutely not. It is not thick, gooey black oil. And if you looked at the water, only when you're very close to the leaking wellhead can you even detect oil with your eye. The water looks a little turbid, so cloudy, like a thick microbial culture, if you would. But it certainly doesn't look like the surface water with the, you know, thick, tarry mats of oil on it. These are very fine particles that are invisible to your eye under most conditions. And you need very sensitive instrumentation to document the presence of these particles. And that's what the optical instruments do for us. They give us a signal of the presence of molecules that are basically invisible to your actual eye.
Is it fair to say that this is a new and presumably almost unknown risk, particularly with deep sea drilling that could happen at other deep sea drilling projects elsewhere in the world?
I think it's only new in the sense that I think everybody is aware of this now. In fact, the Minerals Management Service funded a study back in 2000. The report was published in 2001 and released publicly a few years after that. It was called Project Deep Spill, and the point of the study was to look and see what would happen if you introduced, you know, if you had an oil and gas spill in deep water. And in that study, I believe the water depth was around 2,000 feet instead of 5,000 feet. But they found very similar things, a large fraction of the gas, the dissolved gas, and a good bit of the oil that was released at this depth stayed underwater for weeks to months. So it certainly shouldn't have come as a surprise to anybody in the oil industry that there were going to be deep water features when this spill happened. There have been other modeling studies and papers written based on empirical data that have reinforced the idea that you would get underwater concentrations of oil and gas if you had a deep water blowout. And in fact, the deeper water you're drilling in, the more likely this is going to be because you're dealing with colder water and higher pressure, which is going to facilitate the, you know, trapping of gas in particular at depth.
Are we talking one or several plumes? And if so, how big are they?
Well, there's been at least two plumes that I feel like have been robustly, you know, documented. The first is the plume that's sort of to the southwest of the well, and that's the one that my group and the group from Mississippi, the Pelican Cruise PIs, Vernon Asper and Arnie Dierks found that plume originally, and we followed up and did a lot of the geochemical analyses and microbiology on those plumes. And that plume is about 10 miles, a minimum of 10 miles long and about 3 miles wide and at least 200 meters thick. In most places, some places it's 400 meters thick. There's a plume to the northeast of the well site that's on the order of 26 miles long, 6 miles wide, and, you know, hundreds and hundreds of meters thick. So these are large-scale features, and I think that it's likely that there are others that we don't yet know about. So I feel it's really important for the oceanographic community to keep a presence out there and keep looking for and tracking these features.
As awful as all this is, it's also a new frontier for science. What research needs to be done next?
Well, I think the big question is how fast material in these plumes is going to be degraded using standard microbial processes that are happening naturally in the water, and what factors are going to limit the microbial degradation of oil and gas in these waters. And we really don't understand that, and to sort of the first step in this study is to map the distribution and see how the features are changing, and then you want to try and get an understanding of which microorganisms and which microbial processes are important and relevant and how fast they're going and what's regulating the speed at which they're proceeding. And that requires laboratory studies. And then once you know the plumes, dimensions, and characteristics chemically, and which microbial groups are sort of chewing up the different parts of the plume, the gas versus the oil, you can begin to make models to sort of explain and forecast what will happen in these plumes over time, how they'll evolve, and what kinds of processes will come into play. And I think that's what we want to get, is to a predictive level where we can really understand how the systems are working. But that's going to take quite some time. That's definitely not something that you do in a couple of months. That's you know, years or more of research effort. But I think, you know, we have a situation now that's unfolding each day, and it's really necessary, and it's a responsibility that we all have who are working out there to try and contribute as much as we can to further the understanding of these features and help everybody understand and appreciate how important they are and how they're going to change over time and what their ultimate impact will be on the Gulf system.
Yeah, certainly. The government needs to know, the responders need to know, and we the public need to know. You know, I'd like to change up a bit and ask your opinion about some very frightening theories flooding the airwaves and the Internet. Bear with me for a second. The story goes like this. The giant cavity of oil will leak up for months, say, and then at some point the pressure of the deep will drive seawater down into the very hot earth miles down. That water will become superheated steam, explode violently like a volcano, and cause a tsunami, which will wipe out the Gulf Coast and wash over Florida. From what you know so far, does that sound scientifically plausible?
Not really. And the problem, you have a huge pressure gradient right now going from the reservoir to the seafloor. And that pressure gradient is generated by gas concentration. So the gas is at, when it's pressurized and contained, everything's fine in the reservoir. Well, the reservoir has been punctured, if you will, and the gas and oil are now flowing out. Well, when equilibrium is reached, when there's no pressure gradient from the reservoir to the pipe at the seafloor, then there's no pressure gradient. So there's no force pushing seawater into the system. So effectively, you're going to reach a point where the pressure is nil, and certainly there can be some trickling of seawater into that pipe. You know, you could get some seawater into the reservoir, but it's not going to be at a huge rate because the pressure gradient is equalized between the reservoir and the overlying seawater. So to get seawater into the reservoir, you'd have to have a pressure gradient pushing water from the ocean into the reservoir. Does that make sense? And really, that's just not a situation that is going to be feasible because, remember, that reservoir is hotter than the overlying seawater, so you have to take a lot of energy to push that material into the reservoir, and that's just very unlikely to happen.
Well, all right, there's another hot theory out there. This story builds on the known fact that the Macondo field contains an inordinate amount of methane or natural gas. Some pundits predict a god-awful explosion of methane, which will cause the seafloor of the Gulf to either rise or sink and, again, create a deadly tsunami. How credible would you find that?
Well, again, the issue is the speed at which you're taking, you know, expelling gas from the reservoir. And really, you'd have to ignite that gas underwater in all likelihood. And that's not going to happen. And that sort of is linked in some ways, that question, to another one of those theories that I've seen and that several people have asked me about. Why don't we just blow the well up? Why don't we set off a dynamite charge to just collapse the well on itself? Well, the answer to that is there is a lot of gas down there, and the last thing we want to do is set off a dynamite charge around it. But, you know, in the absence of a dynamite charge, it's very unlikely that this stuff's going to ignite on the, you know, under the ocean and explode and create a giant tsunami. That would be one of those one in a quadrillion type events, and I just don't see that happening. But I think that it's really important for people to keep in mind that that's one of the reasons the amount of methane in this reservoir is the reason that we cannot and should not ever consider setting off a dynamite charge or any other charge for that matter to close this well up, because there is a lot of gas in the system, and if you set off a dynamite charge, you could blow a big hole in the Gulf of Mexico, and that would not be good.
Have you heard about other cracks in the seafloor away from the wellhead that are leaking oil or methane?
I have heard many rumors along those lines, but I have yet to see any data that convinces me that the rumors are true or gives any credence to them. So I, you know, those data could be out there and I haven't seen them, but all I can tell you is I haven't seen anything that makes me conclude that there are ruptures in the seafloor emanating from the wellhead. There are a lot of natural seeps in the Gulf of Mexico, more than 1,000, you know, many, many, many natural seeps. And all of those natural seeps discharge oil and gas at very low rates relative to the well. And, you know, I know there have been some NOAA cruises, for example, that have documented some natural seepage along the seafloor, but nothing that made me think, oh, there's a rupture in the seafloor. I don't think that we're anywhere close to making that conclusion conclusively at this point.
Well, as we wrap up, can you tell us, what is your JOY research group doing now?
Well, we're still processing samples from the Walton Smith cruise. We probably will be doing that for at least another 2 weeks. I'm working on a couple of papers describing our results and, you know, basically generating data plots and whatnot to provide to NOAA and other responders so they can use the data that we've generated to sort of guide additional efforts. But really, we're just pushing through trying to finish the data analyses before we go out on the next cruise, which is about 2.5 weeks from now.
We have been talking undersea science with Dr. Samantha B. Joy, a professor in the Department of Marine Sciences at the University of Georgia and head of the Joy Research Group. You can follow the story at the University of Georgia Gulf Oil Blog. Go to gulfblog.uga.edu. Dr. Joy, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks a lot for your interest.
A little later in the program, we'll check out the new worries about giant plumes of methane in the Gulf of Mexico and the fear of dead zones. But right now, I'd like to get back to the crazy side with Stephanie Mensimer of Mother Jones magazine. Are you ready to be enslaved?
We will enact a martial law in the southern United States. There may be mass FEMA evacuations.
Oh, the FEMA camps.
And kill millions of people, you said.
One thing we know for sure about the blowout tragedy in the Gulf of Mexico, it is a government plot to round up millions of citizens to herd them into horrible FEMA detention camps. At least, that's what we learn from Fringe Radio, that finds a lot of internet attention. We get the scoop from Stephanie Mensimer, a staff reporter at the Washington Bureau of Mother Jones Magazine. Stephanie, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
How did you find out about these top-secret plans to evacuate most of Dixie?
Well, I guess I'm just on the right listserv. But I actually cover the Tea Party movement and some of the right-wing politics that are going on right now, and this just was something circulating in the in their world, basically.
I'm wondering what the evil Obama and his henchmen have in store for us, according to these right-wing sources.
Well, among other things, there were some kind of hysterical emails going out about how the government is planning to forcibly evacuate 50 million people from the Gulf Coast and then put them in FEMA-owned trailers that they like to refer to as concentration camps, somewhere more inland, like in Missouri and elsewhere, so that because the predictions are that the Gulf Coast is going to become uninhabitable thanks to all of the chemicals that they're using to disperse the oil spill. And that's sort of the basis of their conspiracy theory on this one, anyway.
And how does this track back into the Tea Party movement?
I guess there are just people in that movement who are very suspicious of the government. So they seem more prone to believe this kind of stuff. A couple months ago, I wrote a story about how they thought that Obama, there are always these conspiracy theories that Obama is going to impose martial law at some point, and they're the same people who also don't think that the president is an American citizen. So there's just, for whatever reason, I don't know even how many people there are who think like this, but they find each other on the internet, and it kind of gives life to things that maybe, 20 years ago might never have left somebody's backyard in Tennessee. But now, once it gets online, it takes on a life of its own. And there are other, they manage to connect with people who are of similar thoughts.
Well, let's talk about some of the men behind the fear. Who are some of these self-labeled patriots, and how credible are they?
Well, that's a good question. The main person who was talking about this a couple of weeks ago was a guy named Greg Evanson, who is a former Kansas State trooper, and he's now kind of refashioned himself he's on the talk circuit with other patriots in this movement, and he's a bit of a survivalist. He helps teaches people about defensive perimeters and things like that, and how to protect their homes and what to do in case of a crisis. And he sells a bunch of stuff too that you can buy. Like, he has these videos you can get that are about castle defense that can teach you all of the things that he talks about on his talk show. And he actually he says he himself is not a Tea Party member, although he sometimes speaks to Tea Party groups, but he's actually more affiliated with the old kind of militia movement, and some of those leaders who have popped up again through groups like the Oath Keepers and the folks who were involved with Gun Owners of America, for instance. So he's kind of in that world. I'm trying to think. He was one of the main proponents, and then he has a couple of the radio hosts who interview him also obviously think he's a credible source. And it's funny, he lives in Michigan, so I asked him how he happens to know so much about what's going on the Gulf Coast, and he said, oh, well, I have lots of contacts and law enforcement down there, and their people, they just call me because they've heard me talking on the radio about all this stuff. So I guess you can take from that how credible you think he is as a source, and also his sources are.
Well, I listened to a couple of these radio programs about this coming catastrophe, and there's a sudden jump in the logic that really throws me. They start out with widely published facts and some genuine concerns, and then all of a sudden, as matter-of-fact reporting, they explain the role of eternal aliens that are running everything. And we hear this on national radio. Richard C. Hoagland, who thinks aliens are hiding on the moon, explained his theory of utter catastrophe for the people of the Gulf, for millions of people, on coast-to-coast AM radio with George Norrie. And the Gulf is going to explode, he told the audience, and millions of people will die, and it'll wipe out the whole coast 50 miles inland and all of Florida as well, and that will happen in July, Stephanie. Are you ready?
Well, fortunately, I don't live that far down the coast. I shouldn't, in theory, be affected by it.
Oh, it's coming right up the East Coast, too.
Yes, I know they're saying some of the predictions they were talking about, this could go as far north as Cape Cod. But yes, I think it's funny. It's like some of these series are like the stuff of summer blockbuster films. In fact, I think there's one coming out this summer that basically is like that. But, you know, the ocean explodes and the East Coast is wiped out, something to that effect. And I don't know. I talked to a guy at the Coast Guard who is helping with the deep water response, and he was kind of sympathetic because I had to ask him, you know, is there any truth to this that you're going to be evacuating 50 million people from the Gulf Coast? And he said, well, only if there's a really bad hurricane. But he laughed when I told him about some of the conspiracy theories that are flying around on the radio. And he said, I can understand why people are, you know, might be prone to believe some of this stuff because we've just never dealt with anything like this. This really is one of the worst environmental disasters that the country's ever seen. And so people are scared, and they don't really understand what's happening, and so they fall back on some of these other crazy theories for whatever reason. And he didn't think it was that unusual.
Well, it gets helped along by the fact that both BP and the government were hiding how bad this was for a long time and wouldn't show us the footage under the sea and so on.
Yes.
So, I mean, we do have some reason to be suspicious of the government, but I wouldn't take it that far. Well, here's another question for you. How would you get ready for a tsunami caused by the collapse of the seafloor of the Gulf of Mexico? That's one of the theories, going all the way to Middle Earth or something, other than setting up giant FEMA camps.
Yes. Well, and, you know, a lot of this also stems from Katrina because, you know, we did actually, I guess, you know, the oil spill is a little bit different, but, you know, Katrina was an environmental disaster of pretty serious magnitude. And so there is a lot of suspicion based partly, again, in fact, because of what happened after Katrina and the way people were treated down there in New Orleans. And so I think people are kind of extrapolating from that, you know, what might happen. And, you know, they have those pictures of people in the Superdome for 3 days and, you know, this notion that it's either starving to death in the Superdome or being warehoused in the FEMA camps. And so I think that fuels a little bit of this stuff.
Well, the government's damned if they do and damned if they don't, because, I mean, if there is a genuine emergency, and there is some concern about these chemicals in the air, no doubt about that, but if the government doesn't have a plan to evacuate people, then the same people would slam Obama for abandoning the people of the South for not having a plan. So there's no way for the government to win on this one, is there?
Not really. And again, you know, going back to Katrina, you know, people were complaining about the so-called Katrina concentration camps and how terrible these trailers were that they were housing people in after the hurricane. But then when they were proposing to take people out of those camps, there were protests about that too. The government is evicting people and going to make them homeless by kicking them out of the FEMA trailers. So
please let me stay in the FEMA camp.
Yes, they really were, and so, you know, they didn't want to leave. It is a, you know, the government really can't win, and they, you know, I don't think they think they're going to have to evacuate 50 million people. But if there is a hurricane down there, they're going to have to do something because they have all those extra people who are working on the relief efforts. And, you know, it would be crazy if they weren't planning something. But I don't think it involves aliens coming out of the desert in New Mexico, the alien-human hybrids that they're talking about on the radio. I don't think those people will be involved.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking Gulf Gusher conspiracies with Stephanie Mensimer, an investigative reporter for Mother Jones magazine. Well, Stephanie, as you know, there are always a few good facts behind any conspiracy theory. It is true that the EPA set up some air monitoring stations in Louisiana, and on a few days when the wind blew towards shore, they found highly elevated levels of nasty chemicals, benzene, hydrogen sulfide, methyl chloride. Do you feel yourself, I know you're not an expert on this, but is it your impression that there could be a genuine health worry for people in the Gulf, and especially for oil cleanup workers?
Yes, I'm sure that that's the case. And, you know, people, I'm really not the best person to talk to about this, but there are people that I work with who are reporting on that, and they definitely think that there is some concern about, you know, are these chemicals they're using to clean up the oil, so in some ways worse than the oil itself. So, I mean, the oil itself is, can be sort of toxic too. So there are always some facts that lie at the heart of some of these conspiracy theories.
Well, here's what makes me just a little bit angry, Stephanie. Big radio networks, some with hundreds of stations, you know, like George Norrie's Coast to Coast and GCN and so on, they're frightening millions of people. They use incredible guests with no fact-checking or even contrary opinions, and this might add to real economic hardship. People may think, well, I better not visit the Gulf and the tourism will go down, and there's psychological fear and stress, I would think, for people already in a bad situation. It's almost like a media attack, and I'm not an American, so I can't help but wonder, why do Americans love to terrorize themselves?
That is a very interesting question. You know, I mean, call me a cynic, but I think a lot of it is actually goes to our entrepreneurial spirit, because if you look at a lot of these people who are making all of these claims, they always have a product to, you know, assuage your concern. So, you know, if you're worried about how you're going to survive the catastrophe, you know, Greg Evanson has his videos you can watch, and you can go to the seed bank to buy your special seeds to grow your survival garden. There's all kinds of stuff that goes along with the stuff that these guys are marketing, and including the companies that will allow you to use gold to buy stuff in case the currency collapses. You know, you can give them your money, they'll give you gold, which then you can hoard until you need it to buy your seed banks and all that. So I think that's part of it. And the other stuff, I really don't know why Americans are like this. I guess we there is definitely something in our national culture that makes people kind of prone to both believing and perpetuating conspiracy theories, and I don't know exactly what that comes from.
I wonder, you know, given the various crises we face, we've got a couple of wars going on, we've got a bad economic situation, and now we have this almost unending ecological problem. Are we cracking under the stress? Are some people going back to the mentality of the Middle Ages?
I don't know if it's quite that bad, but, you know, I think that in times of, you know, aside from the Gulf spill just happened to happen in the middle of a really terrible recession in the U.S., so, and globally, and there's a lot of insecurity, and when you have a situation like that, people tend to, you know, they're looking for safety in the past. They look back, you know, if you hear like the Tea Party movement, people are always talking about, we need to take our country back. You know, they have this sort of ideal, this sort of golden-hued vision of what things used to be like, say, in the 50s when everything was so much better. I think there's a fair amount of that going on. And when people get nervous, they tend to believe all kinds of crazy stuff. It's not the first time that it's happened here.
Well, Stephanie, as we wrap up, is there anything else that you'd like to add or a direction your research might take you?
Not that I can think of. I just think it's a kind of an interesting phenomenon. I wish, you know, this is someone you might want to consider for your show at some point. There's a psychologist here in D.C. who used to work for the CIA who's made a whole study out of political paranoia, and I keep thinking I should pick up his book because it's kind of interesting. It's and you know, as much as we like to think this is kind of an American phenomenon, it's not just here, and there are interesting political ramifications for it too. You know, if you have if some of these ideas, and if the government starts responding to enough of the craziness on the radio, it can make for some pretty bad policy decision making. So hopefully that's not going to happen, and the Gulf spill is going to be cleaned up, and you know, the oil will stop flowing, and things will go back to relative normalcy.
And who is that psychologist?
Gerald Post, that's his name. Good. He's at George Washington University, I think.
I'll look him up. Thanks so much. And I want to thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Sure. Thanks very much for having me.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex. Next up, a shot of science from an expert who just testified before Congress. He says the time for offshore oil is coming to an end.
And Daddy, won't you take me back to St. Bernard Parish, way down on the bayou where paradise lay. I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. British Petroleum has washed it away.
As we've just found out, deep-sea oil drilling is risky business. Now there is a new danger in the Gulf of Mexico, methane leaking under the sea. Dr. Michael Hirschfield is chief scientist at Oceana, the well-known international voice for the world's oceans. In the middle of June, he testified to a congressional committee about the risks of deep-sea drilling. Dr. Hirschfield, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks a lot, Alex. Glad to be here.
First of all, I listened to your testimony to the House of Representatives. You gave them three recommendations from Oceana when it comes to the deep-sea oil industry. Can you tell us about those?
Yes, we fundamentally think that the day of oil drilling offshore has come and gone, and that we need to move beyond offshore drilling to a new carbon-free energy economy. And so we think it's critical for the administration and for Congress to put a stop to new offshore drilling, and we think it's critical for the administration and Congress to move on to get serious about conservation and new sources of energy like offshore wind and solar.
It makes sense to me. I want, though, really to talk to you today about this new wrinkle in this ever-expanding disaster, it seems to me. Scientists are deeply worried about the impacts of methane on sea life. BP estimates about 40% of the flow we see on those ROV cameras is not oil, but natural gas or methane. Considering the huge volume, I wonder if this is one of the single biggest methane releases on the planet in modern times. What would your opinion be on that?
From everything that I've read, I would have to agree. It looks like it may well be more methane coming up from a single spot than we've seen at any other time in history.
Beats out even those leaking Russian natural gas pipelines, I would say. Can you walk us through what happens to the methane escaping in those deep sea conditions?
Yeah, I mean, what we tend to forget is that although methane is a gas in room temperature or in your furnace, down a mile below the seafloor, it's under incredible pressure and it's very cold. So it's behaving a bit differently, and it's actually not just quickly bubbling out of the water like you might expect in seltzer or something like that. It's actually dissolving in the water. And one of the things that scientists are learning is that the behavior of oil, the behavior of natural gas, and particularly methane at the bottom of the deep sea is different from what we're used to seeing when we see a tanker spill or something in very shallow water. So the methane's becoming dissolved, and it's becoming dissolved in concentrations that many scientists say are higher than they've ever seen before.
Before we get to the impacts on sea life under there, I'm wondering, does some of this methane escape as far as the surface where it could become a serious greenhouse warming gas?
Yeah, I mean, the answer is yes. Some of the methane is certainly escaping to the atmosphere. And when it does, all of the science tells us that methane is a very serious greenhouse gas. One of the big open questions right now is what fraction of the methane that's bubbling up from the seafloor actually ends up in the water versus how much is ending up escaping to the atmosphere.
I guess that may be what Dr. John Kessler from Texas A&M is heading out there to measure right now.
Yes, I think there's a lot of interest in this. One of the things, as you said at the beginning, every day we learn something new and different about the consequences of a horrendous leak or crack in the world's crust that's spewing out oil and natural gas and its consequences to the sea. Unfortunately, it's an unprecedented experiment, and so far all of the results of the experiment are bad.
Well, we do know that some of that methane will freeze into that slush called clathrates on the seafloor, but that could be released later again if the Gulf water's warm enough.
Yes, exactly. It's these slushy methane compounds are not particularly stable. And so actually one of the concerns about global warming generally is the release of methane from these melting methane clathrates.
Let's get to the immediate worry, which is, I think, the impact of all this natural gas or the methane on undersea marine life. What do we know about that?
I mean, the interesting thing is we know very little about methane toxicity itself. I am unaware of any studies where anybody has tested the, you know, sort of the acute toxicity or even if methane is toxic at all to marine life. What we do know is that methane is a dandy food source for bacteria. And what that means is the bacteria are going to break it down to use it for energy, but unfortunately in so doing, they use oxygen just like we do when we metabolize food. And if you have really high concentrations of methane and really fast action from bacteria, that runs the risk of reducing oxygen levels in the water column to levels that can no longer support life.
And I guess the X factor in that is we don't know what these dispersants will do to that mix.
Yeah, I mean, it's really tempting for scientists to look at single factors. So it's really tempting to say, okay, so what's the consequence of the methane? And then somebody else to say, so what's the consequence of the dispersant? Somebody else to say, what about the toxicity from the oil? But what we really need to recognize is that all of this is happening together, and there's a dilute toxic soup down there with dispersants and high levels of methane and a certain amount of oil. So you're potentially stressing any, you know, particularly the bottom-dwelling organisms that can't swim away. You're subjecting these organisms to toxicity at the same time that they may not be getting enough oxygen.
Well, let's say that the oxygen is reduced. What kinds of creatures could suffer the most?
Really, what we've seen in other areas where you end up with reduced dissolved oxygen levels is many of the seafloor invertebrates, the corals, the sponges, the shellfish of almost any kind are going to be directly affected because they can't swim away. Many of them may be able to survive for a short period of time with low oxygen levels, but ultimately it can be fatal. And then there are the organisms that, you know, need to be in particular places, particular depths or particular temperatures to feed. So it could be something like squid or dolphins or porpoises or whales. They may naturally want to swim into a certain area because that's where their food ordinarily would be. If the oxygen levels are too low, they're going to avoid them.
You know, I thought that we would have a really good knowledge of the undersea life in the Gulf, considering all the environmental assessments that must have been done. But now we find out that really isn't the case, and we don't have the resources to track undersea life very well. Do you think it's fair to say we may never know the full impact of this leak on sea life in the Gulf of Mexico?
I think it's 100% certain that we will never know the true impacts of this disaster on undersea life. One of the things that, as you just said, you know, we know the Gulf about as well as anywhere, and the list of things that we don't know about the Gulf would fill many, many more textbooks than the things that we do know. And what we're learning now is not only do we really not know what's down there or how they interrelate when there isn't oil around, we know even less about what happens when you subject the Gulf ecosystem to oil and natural gas. And that's one of the main reasons why Oceana and other groups like us really want to see our addiction to offshore drilling and our addiction to oil generally come to an end, because we know even less about what those ecosystems like and what the consequences would be in places like the Arctic or in places like the Pacific or the Atlantic, where there are proposals for new offshore drilling.
So true. Now look, if this oil slick or the undersea plumes get caught up in the loop current, as some predict, do you think coral and other marine species could be heard in Florida or even up the eastern seaboard? Is that possible?
I think the answer is yes, it's possible. It becomes less likely as you travel up the coast simply because of the nature of the currents. You know, you'd have to have combinations of relatively unlikely things happen to have it get pushed in towards, say, the Chesapeake Bay or that area once, because the current is fundamentally going to be heading out, main part of the current is going to be heading out to sea and across the Atlantic as the Gulf Stream. But yes, I mean, the Florida Keys are at risk as the current comes around. If the oil gets entrained in the loop current and it goes there relatively rapidly, you could see impacts on the coral reefs there. And similarly around the southeast corner of Florida. And again, hopefully less likely up the east coast of the U.S. as the currents take the residual oil out to sea. The good news is on that front that the longer the oil stays in the Gulf and bakes in the sun and, you know, isn't hit by a hurricane, the more it's going to weather, which means that the volatile pieces like the methane and, you know, like other, like the gasoline or the jet fuel fractions of the oil, they're going to evaporate off, and a lot of the rest of it has the chance to be chewed up by the bacteria. So instead of having lots of very, very nasty and immediately toxic liquid or sticky oil like we're seeing in the Gulf, you're more likely to see tar balls, which are not good by any means, but are not as bad as the oil in the Gulf. Of course, what that means is that you either get it quickly in the Keys or and on the East Coast, or it stays in the Gulf and it hurts the Gulf for a longer period of time. There's no win there.
Right. This is Radio EcoShock talking with Dr. Mike Hirschfield, chief scientist at the nonprofit conservation group Oceana. Mike, what is your appraisal of the latest efforts to contain or clean up the big leak in the Gulf? Can you give us a quick update?
Yeah, the short answer is, as we've seen, once the oil's in the water and once it's spewing forth a mile down, there's no good solutions. It looks like some of the efforts to cap or put a cap on the well and siphon some of the oil up to the surface, that those efforts are succeeding to a significant extent. Of course, the amount of oil that isn't being captured is now acknowledged to be greater than the total amount that was estimated to be coming out at the beginning. So, you know, we're ahead of where we might be, but we're still seeing staggering amounts of oil coming out on a daily basis. The best ultimate solution now remains getting a relief well down to hit the spot where the original well reached, and that's not estimated to happen until perhaps, you know, the beginning of August as a successful effort. And, you know, there's no guarantees that it will hit the first time or the second time.
Right. Well, as we're wrapping up, I'm wondering if there's anything that you would like to add for our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I guess I would say is it's really important for all of us when we're wrestling with the question, what can I do, which all of us are feeling, what can I do to help in the Gulf, to recognize that the biggest help that we can do for the creatures in the Gulf, for the people in the Gulf, in the long run, is to curb our oil habit. And whether it's think twice before driving that extra mile or setting your thermostat in the winter just a little bit higher, if you've got an oil furnace, you might want to set it just a little bit cooler. But also to tell your elected officials really that we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore, and we want them to stop offshore drilling and get us off of oil.
We have been talking with Dr. Mike Hirschfield, chief scientist at Oceana. Find out more at oceana.org. Thank you so much, Mike, for your time today.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Then the oil companies came with the world's largest dredges. They tortured the marshes and stripped the wetlands. And they drilled for their oil till the swamps were forsaken. And they wrote it all down as the progress of man. And Daddy, won't you take me back to St. Bernard Parish, way down on the bayou where paradise lay? I'm Sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. British Petroleum has washed it away. Let my soul roll on up to Breton Sound sands. I'll be halfway to heaven with paradise waiting just 5 miles away from wherever I am. And Daddy, won't you take me back to St. Bernard Parish, way down on the bayou where paradise waits. I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. British Petroleum has washed it away. And British Petroleum has washed it away.
And, of course, that's an adaptation for the Gulf Spill of a John Prine song by a band called The Rambling Letters. I got it from a BBC program called World Have Your Say, broadcasting live from Louisiana. After I talked with Mike Hirschfield, I began to think more about those methane clathrates frozen at the bottom of the sea. Dr. Kessel of Texas A&M U confirms this Gulf gusher is indeed the largest single release of methane in human history. Some of that will get into the air, possibly punching up the temperatures in the coming decades. Most of it will freeze down in the deep sea, waiting to erupt 50 or 100 years from now, a curse for our descendants. And it could all have stayed safely deep under the earth where nature put it. You have to wonder how much carbon is going up from all those billowing black Gulf oil fires. Some of those burn 2,000 gallons at a crack. BP says it's the main rig and the Q4000 ship that can burn up to 420,000 gallons of oil a day, and they're aiming for up to 2 million gallons. Another article says BP is already burning 600,000 gallons a day. Professor Jeff Chanton from Florida State University says somewhere between 10 to 50% of the methane we talked about coming out of the well is reaching the atmosphere, partly because oil is coating the bubbles. Jennifer Grayson, editor of the Red, White, and Green, did some rough calculations based on a lowball estimate of just 15,000 barrels a day leaking from the well. Grayson does the conversions and says the methane coming out equals 13,000 metric tons of CO2 equivalent a day, quote, more than 80% of the daily CO2 emissions from the entire New York metro area, end quote. But really, the spill is at least four times larger than that. It's rough math, but we can all agree this ain't good for the climate.
Water's getting higher, past the show, well, the CO2 is climbing, and nobody did a thing today. Everybody was riding around in an SUV, you say, while the scientists are screaming, the U.S. was dreaming, and China coming on so strong, the CO2 went all wrong.
And thank you, Dana Pearson, for that little clip. Over at the Real Climate blog, David gives a different perspective. Just living out our fossil fuel lives, driving around, we're all leaking, the equivalent of about 2,000 Gulf oil spills a day. Our lives are just carbon-making machines. I'm still wondering, what are they doing with all those plastic bags of weathered oil collected by the cleanup workers? One guess, it will go back into deep injection wells on land. So we've reached complete carbon capture and storage already. Why bother with the middle layer of consumers? Just haul it out of the sea and shoot it straight back underground. We'd all be better off than if we burned it in the atmosphere.
I have scientists who have contacted me now, and others alerting me inside the government that both FEMA and Homeland Security are very concerned that their scientists are telling them it's the danger of a volcanic tsunami occurring. That means when the oil, at some point, whether it's 2 months or 10 months, but it's more likely to happen in the soon, like probably by the middle of the summer, that if enough oil comes out and seawater gets down there and it gets below the zone where the oil is and it makes contact with the magma, which is pushing up the oil, then we're likely to see a superheated steam, which is what drives all of the volcanoes from along the subduction zone, say the Ring of Fire, is all driven by steam. Most people don't realize the steam actually is the thing that drives it, and it's likely to cause a giant explosion with the change in the ocean floor and a tsunami that they estimate could be between 80 and 200 feet high, going 400 to 600 miles an hour. It could carry 50 to 100 miles inland and could cross, because most of the floor is only 50 feet above sea level.
Talking about the wackos and fear merchants opening this program, I forgot about Pastor Lindsay Williams on the Alex Jones Show. He'll put the fear of God into you and help Ted's GCN network sell you some gold with tales of chemical poisoning of the Gulf population. It's over the top, and it's maybe kind of true. Catch that all on YouTube. All those links are in my Radio EcoShock blog for June 24th, 2010. Speaking of over the top and maybe true, I promised you the geopolitical granddaddy rumor of the Gulf. This one comes from Wayne Madsen, a kind of spook investigator, Washington insider, broadcaster, and podcaster. Writing at oilprice.com, Madsen says, quote, "Sources within the U.S. Army Corps of Engineer and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, the Pentagon, and Interior and Energy Departments told the Obama administration that the newly discovered estimated 3 to 4 billion barrels of oil in the Gulf of Mexico would cover America's oil needs for up to 8 months if there was a military attack on Iran that resulted in the bottling up of the Strait of Hormuz to oil tanker traffic, resulting in a cutoff of oil to the United States from the Persian Gulf. Obama, Salazar, Chu, and Gates greenlighted the risky Macondo drilling operation from the outset, according to Wayne Madsen reports government sources. WMR learned that BP was able to have several safety checks waived because of the high-level interest by the White House and Pentagon in tapping the Gulf of Mexico bonanza in order to plan a military attack on Iran without having to be concerned about an oil and natural gas shortage from the Persian Gulf after an outbreak of hostilities with Iran," end quote. You can find out more at WayneMadsenReport.com. Well, according to the Wall Street Journal, quote, BP is the single biggest supplier of fuel to the Department of Defense, with Pentagon contracts worth $2.2 billion a year, according to government records. BP is also the largest producer of oil on federal waters in the Gulf of Mexico, which makes it a significant contributor of revenue to the government, end quote. Several sources report 11 American warships, including the aircraft carrier USS Truman, plus some Israeli Navy ships, passing through the Suez Canal in mid-June. The Iranians complain they're being set up for an attack. So who knows? Maybe the administration and the Pentagon are really counting on their single biggest supplier of fuel. It's possible they help BP speed up the Deepwater Horizon hole to get a production rig on there ASAP. If so, the geopolitics of the Middle East may have contributed to the Gulf oil disaster. Is it too much to hope that losing this field and others coming from Gulf production could deter a crazy attack on Iran? It's a strange old world. Almost anything is possible, even peace. Get ready for a good summer. It may be the best we have for a while. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
And now, the Hall of Fantasy.
Could you also not sink if you go right over a bubble like that?
Well, exactly. You would, if a bubble came up, which is what I'm going to get to, you would sink every rig and every ship in the region for miles around this wellhead.
That we need to realize that we're dealing with a vast dark empire. It literally is a star war. It's a cosmic war.
Yep.
With some of the leaders are these amphibial Draco reptilians called the Gorgons, and there are other affiliates that are extremely advanced, very malevolent. They are totally a predatory civilization that literally consumes us. and every other civilization they try to come in contact with. They are opposed by a vast empire of civilizations, and we are literally at the cusp of a galactic and a cosmic war. And if they don't believe that, that's why our civilization has fallen 4 other times, and this is the 5th and last time we're going to get a chance.
Well, that's right, and in the spirit of true science, that's a hypothesis, and we can test that against the facts that we know, and it all fits.
Oh my God!